we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
Rival protests in the US city of Berkeley have descended into chaos. Anti-fascist demonstrators broke through police barricades during a rally against hate there, and then they clashed with right-wing activists.
We're here outside of Berkeley Civic Center in downtown Berkeley, California. And as you can see around me, there's a huge crowd of people calling themselves anti-fascist protesters. A lot of different forces out here. Now, one grouping that is widely present is the folks who call themselves Antifa. Some of them also would call themselves the Black Bloc, people with masks over their faces, helmets, goggles. They're here for a fight almost. I mean, they give that impression.
That we are living in an age of false equivalencies has never been more evident than in the aftermath of Charlottesville, where you will recall hundreds of white supremacists and nationalists descended on the town to protest the planned removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, only to be met by hundreds of counter-demonstrators who'd gathered under the banner of Antifa. Now, even though I'm sitting here in the UK, I'm clear whose side I am on, and it certainly ain't the Confederate flag-carrying knuckle-draggers for whom white is right. Because when it comes down to it, you can either be on the side of those who walk in the footsteps of the slave owners in the South, or you can walk in the footsteps of those who oppose them. Yet astoundingly, we have witnessed an attempt to draw a moral equivalence between both sets of protesters in recent weeks, an attempt that was given its lead by Donald J. Trump, the President of the United States. And why? On what basis? Let me tell you. Simply because those who marched under the banner of Antifa refused to be cowed and instead stood their ground and fought fire with fire. Learning the lessons of history is never more crucial than when it comes to the difference between fascism and anti-fascism, especially, as I say, in this age of false equivalencies. And just as an aside, this includes a concerted attempt to posit communism and fascism as two sides of the same coin. Garbage. Just as it doesn't take a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, neither does it require an exegesis of Lenin's State and Revolution or Hitler's Mein Kampf to understand the extent to which both creeds and ideologies differ. All you need bear in mind, in fact, is that where Nazi Germany unleashed the Holocaust, the Soviet Union ended the Holocaust, and all else, as they say, is embroidery. So I'm clear. Antifa's stance in Charlottesville, and anywhere else racist and supremacist groups gather, is both principled and courageous. And just like the men and women of eastern Ukraine, who since 2014 have been resisting the writ of a government that was propelled into power on the back of a coup driven by avowed neo-fascists and ultra-nationalists, and just like those who risk and, in thousands of cases, have given their lives in a struggle against the incarnation of fascism in the Middle East, i.e. Daesh, Antifa in the US carries forward the banner of hope for those who have found themselves dehumanised and demonised in the cause of racial, ethnic or religious supremacy. And when Bertolt Brecht wrote after the Second World War that the womb from that which crawled remains fertile, he was referring to the womb of capitalism, out of which fascism emerged. And Brecht knew that all it would take would be another economic crisis and depression for fascism to crawl out of its swamp again, exploiting said crisis to scapegoat and blame migrants, blacks, Hispanics, in sum, anyone who doesn't measure up according to fascism and its adherents' perverted worldview. This is not, by the way, to endorse the violence and affray that erupted in Charlottesville, violence that included the murder of anti-fascist activist Heather Heyer, but when the system breaks down, violence increasingly becomes the rule rather than the exception, wherein the struggle in the streets starts to take precedence over politics as usual. And in the White House, we have a dysfunctional government which has been lurching from one self-inflicted crisis to another while engaging in the kind of poisonous rhetoric you might associate with thuggery rather than democracy. And this cannot but sow dragon's teeth. This, I contend, is what we are seeing now today, across the United States. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, Naveed Nassar is a political commentator and writer, and he has expert knowledge on the rise of Antifa in the United States, and he joins me now. Naveed, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John. It's good to be back.
Now, give me your analysis, first of all, of what happened, what ensued after the events of Charlottesville. I mean, I think I get the sense, I mean, you're obviously more plugged into events in the United States. You've got connections here, even though you're based in Europe now. But I got the sense that the establishment was surprised, not so much by the white supremacists, but the anti-fascist demonstrator, because for the first time, they took a kind of stand that the anti-fascist demonstrators in the United States and elsewhere throughout the West have never really taken. They've always been the sort of nice, woolly protesters standing with their placards, you know, almost holding hands, singing Kumbaya. And that's not to disparage that kind of protest. But here we see a different culture emerging, Naveed, where these young people, and I have to commend their courage, took it to them in the streets on their own terms.
Well, I would say that the response, the anti-fascist response to the Charlottesville demo was not something brand new, something that personally, not something that I haven't seen before. I saw it during Occupy. I've seen it since then when Richard Spencer's think tank, the National Policy Institute, has organized gatherings in the Washington, D.C. area. It's not always just placards and things like that. But, you know, before it was called Antifa, it was called ARA, Anti-Racist Action. It's not a brand new thing for me. I've seen and I've known activists involved in this milieu, so it's not shocking or something new. I think the thing that really shocked people, if you know, for lack of a better word, is just the fact that the media attention,
yes,
that Charlottesville generated, and the numbers of the alt-right, white supremacists, whatever, white nationalists, whatever other euphemism you want to use, their numbers that they turned out, at least in the hundreds. The most conservative estimate that I've seen was 500, but I think it was probably over 1,000. And that's the first time that's ever happened. I mean, as long as I've been involved in this kind of thing, traditionally what has happened is, you know, everyone says, oh, there's going to be a Klan march. The Klan is coming, you know. And people organize around that and turn out, and it's portrayed as a very important thing when it's sort of like Kabuki theater, because it's like you go and then you see there's like maybe 10 quote unquote Klansmen, you know, and anytime in those gatherings of those 10 Klansmen, half of them are going to be undercover police. You know, that's just how it is. And facing off with them is 200, you know, anti-fascists or radicals or whatever. You know, liberals, progressives, all sorts of people. This is different. This is different because of the size of the crowd and because these are not undercover cops or backwoods types. And you could tell by looking at them. These were petty bourgeois people. These are college grads, a lot of them, well-fed.
A product of white privilege, you might say.
Yes, possessing all their teeth, speaking in full sentences. These aren't people that you can readily make fun of with all the old
stereotypes
and cliches about what a white supremacist is, you know, and there were tons of them. It wasn't just a dozen of them or half a dozen of them or even 50 of them. Many, many, many times more than that, they turned out, you know, to their credit. And that's, I think, the difference here. These are not the sons of the 1% necessarily, but let's say of the top 10%, you know, let's say that. And that's why it's not quite as easy for, I think at least, for the mass media to fully climb on board and demonize and attack these people and valorize their opponents. Initially, that was the case when the whole thing was tied into Trump, and it was about opposition to Trump, and it was about the quote unquote resistance. In that case, the Washington Post, the New York Times, anything that in any way, shape, or form equated Trump himself with fascism, was lauded, was applauded, was encouraged. But this is different. This is different. We're talking about on the ground people, and we're talking about people who look like their own kids, you know, who are going to Charlottesville and saying, you know, Jews will not replace us, and, you know, all the other things that they were chanting, you know. So that's the difference here is this has finally come out of, you know, just half a dozen people here and 100 people there and 500 police separating them. It's not Kabuki theater anymore, and it has real consequences, and the media has turned against Antifa. We've seen that in the past few weeks, not just, you know, and all across the board, the mainstream media, the alternative media, the progressive media, they're all, you know, speaking in similar ways. And some of what I've read and heard is
so do you discern that the liberal establishment, because we're talking about liberal, the CNN and MSNBC, yeah, they've been very hard on Antifa. But do you discern that they see Antifa as a bigger threat to the status quo than actually these white supremacists and racists that were marching?
I think what it is, I think honestly, it's kind of a Kissingerian scenario for the establishment, where anything that can't easily be controlled and corralled is seen as a threat.
Yes.
You know, and that's the only reason Trump is seen as a threat. It's not his ideology.
It's the same as Black Lives Matter. That was another, you know, a terrorist group, and, you know, they're out of control, and how dare they protest too loudly, and how dare they stand up in the way they're doing? How dare they not come to us and sort of, in a way, reach out to liberals to try and get them sucker, like the Democratic Party and Clinton and so forth. And this is what I was mentioning, Naveed. There seems to be a new culture that's arising in the States, a culture of resistance, with the younger generation is not any longer going to allow itself to be constrained by these invisible parameters of acceptable protest and acceptable channels of political engagement and resistance to injustice.
Well, that's partly what's going on. Absolutely. It's important to point out several things, though. One is that since we're talking about it, I don't want it to become the whole focus of the discussion, but BLM is not, there's an organization. There's kind of like that has sort of copyrighted or trademarked the name, but BLM is just a slogan.
Okay.
That's all it is, and anyone can raise up that banner. And the reason it came about is not because you know, the all lives matter people don't get it. The reason the Black Lives Matter slogan came about is because police were murdering Black people on any pretense, and not just police, but vigilantes were murdering Black people on any pretense and getting away with it.
Yes.
Which meant that these lives didn't matter. Hence, Black Lives Matter. It's not a slogan of Black supremacy, if such a thing was possible.
No.
But it's literally a slogan of saying you can't just kill us with absolute impunity. That's all it means. And there is an organization now, sort of, that has I don't know what the right word is, co-opted or whatever that slogan. And to be frank and totally honest, a lot of the leadership of Black Lives Matter Incorporated, if you want to call it that, is affiliated with the Democratic Party. They've made no bones about that when they go on the media. And it's also obvious that some of those folks are angling to get political seats.
Okay.
You know, but that's different from the street movement, from people on the street protesting themselves and family members and friends being killed with absolute impunity. And so this is also what we need to talk about when we talk about Antifa. Yes, there is a wing of Antifa that I'll name drop here because I think it's important.
I'm going to have to stop you there, for we'll have to take a short break. Hold that thought. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after this.
Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Naveed Nazir. We're discussing the false equivalence that's being drawn between Antifa, the anti-fascist counter-demonstrators in Charlottesville and the white supremacists and white nationalists who were marching against them. Now, Navid, you made the point about Antifa. Now, Antifa is not a homogenous bloc, I believe. It's an umbrella name for a bunch of different groups with their own different political beliefs and their own vision. Anarchists, you may have radical liberals, communists, socialists, and so forth. Give me your understanding of how Antifa came together, how it coalesced. Now, the organisation, the way that they organise, what is it that makes them so strong? Because as you say, it's as if they've yet to be corralled by the status quo, by the system. What is their secret?
Well, here's the thing. The secret, if you want to call it that, is people inherently, most people, I think, inherently feel a visceral reaction when they see people openly, unashamedly, unabashedly spouting white supremacist rhetoric, spouting eliminationist rhetoric, spouting, you know, this kind of ideology openly, unabashedly, you know, and they want to put a stop to it because they realize what it means. What it means when these people are no longer afraid, what it means when just open and in your face about it. And so opposition to this, opposition to fascism, it cuts across the board. It cuts across the board. And you don't have to be, frankly, a lot of what people consider Antifa really is black bloc anarchists. And they're confusing and conflating the two. You know, when they say, oh, those Antifa guys, they're wearing masks and this and that. No, you're talking about black bloc, which is a tactic that certain anarchists have been using for about 20 years now, at least. That's a different thing. Although yes, there are a large part of what's considered Antifa, and there are a large part of the street fighters or whatever of Antifa. But I can tell you, yes, there are communists. Yes, there are socialists. Yes, there are liberals. Yes, there are progressives. All these people who rally behind a kind of like big umbrella of Antifa are, because all it is, all it takes for you to literally be quote unquote Antifa is to openly, verbally, and physically oppose fascism where it appears. That's it. So it's not, you don't have to espouse a certain ideology. You don't have to sign a blood oath. You don't have to, there's no membership dues. Literally, you just say, hey, I think this stinks, and I want to confront it and oppose it wherever it rears its ugly head. That's it.
Now, interestingly, I mean, it's not only Donald Trump and the mainstream who have been drawing this false equivalence between Antifa and the other side, the white supremacists, racists and pseudo-fascists, but also people who should know better, I would suggest, on the left. People who are up in arms about what's going on in Ukraine, which I mentioned in my introduction. And it seems to me there's a real cognitive dissonance underpinning this narrative, and it's almost like you cannot be against fascism in Ukraine but apologise for it or try and justify it or try and alibi it when it appears in the United States. And I put this down to the unconscionable extent to which some people are still trying to defend Donald Trump 8 months into his presidency. And it really comes down to this, Navi, doesn't it? When the facts change, so should your analysis and your position change. Now, you and I were both encouraged by some of the noises coming out of the Trump campaign in the lead up to the 2016 presidential election about resetting relations with Russia, about ending all these foreign wars and so on. 8 months into his presidency in 2017, that's gone. It's over. And these people who are trying to say, oh, he's a victim of the deep state of the establishment, that may be, but he's still the president. He's a man who's coming out with all this violent rhetoric against North Korea, brought us to the brink of nuclear Armageddon. There's still NATO troops, thousands of NATO troops deployed on Russia's borders. And we know for a fact that fascism in Ukraine is not only, the flag of fascism is not only flying in Ukraine, it's flying high in Ukraine as we speak. Give me your understanding of what's taking place, this cognitive dissonance, as I say, in sort of more progressive circles with regard to the political situation in the States, specifically with Donald Trump's presidency at this point.
Yeah, they're initially for those of us who've been paying attention for years and who dug deeper than the slogans and the surface level, it was clear to us what Hillary was, is, and represents and represented. Very clear. Trump made noises about being an outsider, and he said certain things about Russia, and he said certain other things about NATO, you know, and he said a few other things. And because many of us have been thirsty, the things that he said when it came to foreign policy were actually more quote unquote progressive and peacenicky than Bernie Sanders, who did not make those kinds of noises when it came to the foreign policy front, that explicitly did not, and explicitly upheld the foreign policy establishment's view of the world when it comes to any number of things, including Syria, including North Korea, including, other things. So Trump was different in that regard with regards to just at least what he was saying. But and I'll give credit to the people who were closely following this last year when I wasn't. At least as early as late summer of last year, when it became clear that it was going to be a much closer race than people expected between Trump and Clinton, and that Trump had at least a fighting chance of winning, it was clear by the people Trump was bringing in around him that this was not going to be a puff the magic dragon kind of administration.
All insiders, all establishment insiders, wasn't it?
All banksters, all generals, all neocons. It was not going to be, and the people who were quote unquote outside the establishment were thoroughly repulsive people like Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller. There was, unless Trump himself was some sort of brilliant genius who was surrounding himself, you know, with a cabinet that would. The stuff that people continue to believe about Trump is just, it's mind numbing. And it's saddening to see the continued faith and belief in this man and his administration as some sort of radical break with the past or with the U.S. imperial presidency but yes, you're right. That is at the core of it. That is at the core of why any kind of, not just this kind of official hashtag resistance kind of thing, that it was obvious right from the start that it was going to end in 2 years when the congressional elections were going to happen. Like that, not just that, but any kind of opposition to Trump, any kind of organized opposition to Trump in a lot of circles, particularly in the alternative media, but elsewhere, is perceived as being directly generated by
George Soros.
George Soros. Yeah. Or by Hillary or whatever. Like, I mean, it's literally so, yeah. Like, you can't even like hold a sign in opposition to Trump without people saying, oh, is this
utterly shallow and facile, isn't it? Because you oppose Trump, it does not automatically mean that you support Hillary Clinton or Obama or that creed. You and I both oppose them stringently, and we always will, because we know what they've done, the crimes that they've committed under the rubric of liberalism. But that doesn't mean we have to support Donald Trump. This man is a monster.
Yeah,
this man is a megalomaniac. He's a sociopath. He's narcissistic to the nth degree.
Here's the thing: the apologia for Trump and for, I mean, let's call, you know, at least the outlying ideology of a lot of his base. We can say sort of that it's, if not outright white supremacy, at least it's like white chauvinism.
Yes.
Let's call it that. Okay. Now, you know, the apologia like for Trump from intelligent people, from people who know better, is really bizarre. It extends to things even like Milo Yiannopoulos and his apologia for pedophilia and things like that. Like people who on the right 6 months earlier would have been like, pedophiles need to be strung up, by their genitals. All of a sudden, we're making every excuse in the world, and we're saying that the people who are out to get this guy, Milo, are paid by Soros.
Yes.
You know, like that kind of thing. Are this apologia, for, again, I'm glad you put Ukraine on the table. I can also put, you know, the Ustasha in Croatia on the table, because people who are verbally, adamantly opposed to them, all of a sudden, because of Trump and his base, you know, they find these virtues in the Confederacy and in its monuments and in its figures, its leading lights, yes. You know, whether it's Robert E. Lee, whether it's Bedford Forrest, yes. Whether it's Jeb Stuart, whether it's Stonewall Jackson.
These were racist killers. These were racist psychopaths, weren't they? In uniform.
These were psychopaths. These were white supremacists, no doubt about it, explicitly in their own words and in their actions. That's what they were. Mass murderers. There was nothing noble about what they did. Nothing noble about what they did whatsoever.
Absolutely.
Whatsoever. There's no multiple sides that you can, if you're reading multiple, what you're doing is, God, you have to give them credit. I don't want to get too far off on this tangent, but there were organized efforts in the South in the period after Reconstruction, which was the period following the Civil War, beginning with the turn of the 20th century, organized efforts at rewriting history.
Yes.
And making the Civil War into something other than what it was.
Sanitizing it. And that's what these monuments are. These monuments are not monuments of historical record. They are political monuments. They're ideological monuments, aren't they?
Exactly, because there were two periods, two historical periods when these monuments were constructed and when these roads and schools, et cetera, were given these names. The two periods were right at the beginning of the 20th century when Plessy versus Ferguson was hot and people, especially in the South, were riled up about it. And that's when a lot of these monuments were constructed. And the rest of them were constructed in the 1950s directly in response to the civil rights movement.
Yes.
Directly in response to that. It was a middle finger to the civil rights movement and to black people in the South who were fighting back against segregation, who were fighting back against Jim Crow, and who were fighting back against organized white terror.
But Naveed, can I just make this point? Because we discussed this issue a couple of weeks ago, and I made a mistake in thinking that all these monuments were confined to the former Confederate states in the South. They're not. They're all over the United States. They're in Washington. They're in New York State.
They're in California. They're in Michigan. They're in Iowa. They're in Illinois. States that have had nothing, not only had nothing to do with the Confederacy, but actively fought the Confederacy. Fought the Confederacy. California sent lots of volunteers and not just volunteers, conscripts to fight the Confederacy. Illinois, all of these states, it boggles the mind. When you see that, this is an ideological construct. There's no way it can be denied, because the Confederacy plays no part, zero part, in the quote-unquote heritage of Michigan, of Illinois,
absolutely,
of Iowa, of any of these other states.
So racism, as I have said, is as American as apple pie, and white supremacy also. And in 2017, I see a worrying recrudescence of, you might want to call it fascism. I would say maybe if it's fascism, it's at a very, very early stage. It's not 1942, it's certainly maybe more 1932. But learning the lessons of history, absolutely crucial if we're not to see that history repeated. And one thing I will say is that Donald Trump is our Mussolini. His rhetoric is that of a mafia godfather rather than a president of a democratic country, and he has unleashed the dogs of racism and xenophobia in the United States. And I think it's going to be up to these young people, these young fighters of Antifa, to do something about it. And I think they would give a fillip to people who have been cowed, migrants, Hispanics, Muslims, all those who have been on the sharp end of Donald Trump's rhetoric and who felt the wrath of the hate that's been unleashed on the back of that rhetoric in the streets. And I think that's what the establishment is worried about, that there's people who are willing to fight back, because when push comes to shove, Naveed, I'm sure you will agree, white supremacy is in the very roots of the United States, whether it's liberals or whether it's Republicans. Whether they are conscious of it or not, they sign up to that cultural bedrock of white supremacy, which is seen as coterminous with democracy in America. You've been listening to Naveed Nazar. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.